Hello, my name is Inua Ellems. You're listening to Spilling the Beans. I've just had a really lovely, well-researched and considered conversation with Dom Stevens, and I hope you guys listen for more.
Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. I always describe this podcast as interviews with some of the world's best storytellers, and there's no doubt that my guest today lives up to that title. He is a globally celebrated and multi-award-winning poet, playwright, screenwriter, graphic artist, designer, and actor, whose work has found homes at the National Theatre, the Royal Court, the Royal Shakespeare Company, and the BBC, to name just a few. His first play, The 14th Tale, proved a turning point in his career, winning a Fringe First at the 2009 Edinburgh Festival. But arguably, it was his 2017 play, Barbershop Chronicles, that secured his position globally as a truly great writer. Barbershop Chronicles is a play set in black barbershops across six cities on a single day, against the backdrop of a football match taking place between Chelsea and Barcelona. The play explores the African diaspora in the UK, masculinity, homosexuality, and religion. And for its production, Ellems recorded over 60 hours of genuine conversations happening in barbershops all over Africa, as well as in London, at his own barber Peter's shop, Emmanuel's, in Clapham Junction. The play achieved what many would consider an impossible rise. It went from a project that initially failed to secure funding to enjoying two sold-out runs at the National Theatre, international touring, and was selected as a key text for the A-level curriculum to be studied by every student in the country. In 2019, his work returned to the National with his smash hit Three Sisters, a reworking of the Chekhov play restaging the story in the 1960s in the midst of the Biafran War in Nigeria. It, alongside Barbershop Chronicles, is available to stream now on NT at Home, and I hugely recommend you do so straight after listening to this episode. And last year, he wrote a magnificent episode of Doctor Who, The Story and the Engine, set in a 2019 Lagos barbershop. By doing so, he became the first black man to have written for the television series and the fourth black writer overall, after Mallory Blackman, Charlene James, and Sharma Angel Wolfel. His many accolades include that he is a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, an honorary doctorate from the University of the Arts in London, and being awarded an MBE in the 2023 Birthday Honours List for his services to the arts. A few weeks ago, we sat down to record this very special episode of Spieling the Beans, not least because it ends with a reading of my favourite poem of his. And it's only the second time we've ended an episode of this podcast with the reading of a poem after my interview with Brian Cox, so he's making even more history here. So now please welcome my guest for this episode, Inua Ellems, MBE.
Inua, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thanks for inviting me to the show, Dom.
Let's start big. What makes a great play?
I don't think I know. Is probably the safest answer.
It'll be a short episode.
I say so because there are so many subcategories hidden in that question. What we mean by great and what we mean by play, which means then if I was to think about my favorite experiences of live entertainment that isn't overwhelmingly musical or overwhelmingly physical, right? I think about what I've enjoyed of those experiences. It's probably a community going through change with jeopardy and a clear, consistent aesthetics in telling, in sharing their experience. I think, I don't know. So Jeopardy, a community, change and taste. I don't know. I think those are the things that make a great play. Yeah.
Is it easier to answer what makes a great poem, or are you similarly facing?
What makes a great poem? Let me see. I don't think it's similar. I just think it's different. I think
Sure.
a poem is to theater what a photograph is to cinema.
Yeah.
So a poem is a snapshot, like a photograph is, but the best snapshots are great at holding all narrative within the frame and letting you be the storyteller. You impose yourself on the poem, and it tells you a lot about yourself in the attempt to understand it. And I think photographs also do similar things. Good photography, you figure out what you're drawn to, why you're drawn to it. It asks you more questions than it attempts to answer. So, but also, I don't know, poetry traditions are so varied and so vast and have lots of intertextual, contextual things hitting in symbolism, which I sometimes don't understand. I will never understand. They just have to aggregate and sort of reach an average sense of what the poet might mean and then try and figure out. I think poetry is more subjective and has more room for error than theater can ever truly have, because theater puts the audience in a more powerful situation, in a more powerful position than poetry ever does, I think. Because with theater, the contract is entertainment. If you bore your audience, is the cardinal sin. No, right? Whereas with poetry, you could do whatever the hell you want and you will not be there when the audience are interacting with your poem. Whereas you can sit in the audience and get the play can get booed. Yeah. So yeah, I think the power dynamics and contract with the readers, the experiencers of the art are slightly different. Very
Yeah.
different. Yeah.
No, that's wonderful. I'd never sort of considered the relationship aspects. Like it's very evident in theatre, but yes, with the poems that are largely observed in silence often. I've mentioned to you before we started the recording that my favorite poem of yours is Child God of Chaos. What's the story behind that?
If I remember correctly, I was commissioned to write this for a fashion label called Jigsaw that make clothes here in the UK. And it was a strange commission because I don't really work in the fashion industry, and I only care about fashion to a certain extent. I don't really, to the largest thing, I think it's ridiculous that people spend so much money on things that will disintegrate eventually, and there's so much powder. Anyway, whatever. I've worked with a few designers, friends of mine are, but largely I just take all of it with a pinch of salt. But I was asked to work in this project. And I opted to go and visit the designers in their workshop. And they talked me through the season that I was to respond to, which was the following year. And they were hugely inspired by weather patterns, if I remember correctly. They were thinking about climate change and sustainability. And I think I pitched various things, and the Child God of Chaos was one of them. And I actually haven't thought about this poem in a while, so thank you for bringing it to my attention. Yeah, and it was published in coats. It was printed in the lining of these coats that were fantastically expensive. But yeah, it was really great to watch it. And I just tried to think about a child's growing to understand its power. And there are these One of the most illuminating moments in any child's life, which we've all gone through, is when we realize our fists are connected to our body. And that moment of staring in wonder and your brain sending messages that you're able to comprehend in real time for the very first time, you know. And I just thought about that with relation to the children of deities, what Hercules might have been like as a kid, suddenly realizing he was stronger than anyone else around him, you know. And then thought about superheroes as a kid, especially the mutants in Xavier's home for gifted kids. I'm talking about the X-Men, and they go there to understand their power, learn how to control it, perhaps and to amplify it, and then use it as a force for good. So from that, this poem came, The Child God of Chaos. And yeah, I was really pleased with it and thinking about this little kid understanding that. I think to riff on superhero lore and proverbs, there's this huge reoccurring, and I say huge because of the repercussions and how much it means to the canon of Spider-Man or spider people. There's this thing Uncle Ben says to Peter Parker, with great power comes great responsibility, which drives Peter to really understand humility. I think in a way, none of the other superhumans in either canons, the DC or Marvel, really, really engages with on a profound level. You know, Spider-Man really does that to the point where it drives him nuts. And this is another crazy storyline where he's taken over by Dr. Octopus, and or rather, he takes over Dr. Octopus's body and passes this law that to himself that no one shall die on his watch, which means that he goes out of his way to protect everyone. And there is a thin line between protection and domination, which we're currently seeing play out across so many parts of the world, but particularly in America. Either way, this poem is about a kid growing to understand their power and then the responsibility that comes with it. I think that's what the poem riffs on. Yeah.
And it's so fascinating hearing you talk about that because I know how important sort of mythology is for you. And it was in your sort of early childhood that you discovered the X-Men comics, which have become a sort of such a, it seems like one of your main loves of your life in many ways. You touched on it a bit there, but what is it about those comics that attracted so much passion from you as a young boy and still today you sort of extol its virtues?
I was born into a multi-faith household. My father was a Muslim, my mother was a Christian, and I grew up reading holy texts and, you know, holy books. And I went to a boarding school in Nigeria where we weren't allowed to have comic books because they were sacred. They were, sorry, sacred is the wrong word. They were banned. They were contraband, actually. And which meant that there was a level of secrecy that came to having one and something sacred then about reading a comic book at night and making sure no one was around you know, smuggling between each other, reading it very penitently, very quiet, very hushed. And there was something about that transaction that lent itself to reading the holy text. I used to read the Bible under the covers with the torchlight when we were supposed to be sleeping there. And I was doing the same thing with these superhero comics. And then I was reading about Angel, who was an X-Man. And then I was reading about angels in the Bible. And somewhere, both stories began to blur in terms of the sensorial understanding and the emotional understanding of them. And the Bible, none of the holy texts are to be read literally, because if we do so, we are sinners and we're going to die sinners. Some of them are proverbial and we sift them for its meaning to better understand ourselves and how we think and how we feel. And a lot of the comic books do extremely similar things. If you th th think about some of the stories about Captain America and what he stands for, and often his greatest enemies are the American government itself. And he strikes this balance between being a man of the people and a symbol of the people, and the people create the state and create the republic, but they're often demonized and destroyed by the public, you know. So, you know, and each time you read the story, you discover things about yourself. And some of these stories are very moral in the way some of the stories from the Bible and the Quran are also moral. So various things were happening when I was reading the text. But also, I've seen this meme in heated discussions online about how the proof that Christ exists is the Bible. And the proof that Spider-Man exists is the Amazing Spider-Man comic, which sort of does similar things in collapsing the nature of belief and fandom and meditation and understanding these epic stories about human beings or human frailties in incredible situations and what it means to us to access them and to try and understand ourselves. So, but also, comic books, for me, they are proverbs, they're tales about the potential of humanity and the human body itself, this physical bag of water and matter that we inhabit. I love the slight questions it raises about how we differ, and what happens to that difference. I think about Cyclops, whose difference is that rather than, what's the word? Rather than sucking in light, which is how we see the world, he emits light. So it's a slight mutation, a slight difference, which has profound consequences. And I think about that as regards to what it means to be alive. Someone says something nice to us when we're 5 years old, and that mutates into a belief we have. I had an English teacher who told me that I was good at writing when I was 12. Lo and behold, 3 decades later, it's what I do for a living. That little ripple, that question mutated into what I now do for a living. So the various things I draw from them.
That's beautiful. And yeah, that butterfly effect can sort of just yeah, there's no sort of limit to the sort of the domino effect of that too. There's a great line in one of your recent works of The Half God of Rainfall, which seemed like a perfect encapsulation of what you've been talking about, of this confluence of the religious and the comic book. And it's during a sort of action battle scene that wouldn't be out of place in an X-Men or a Marvel movie or something along those lines. And there's a line said by one of the characters of, "Let he without fault throw the first bolt," presumably mirroring the Bible quote of, "Let he without sin cast the first stone."
Exactly.
And it seems, yeah, sort of an encapsulation of we think of them as very similar, but you're absolutely right that there's so much crossover in proverb and morality and mythology. I heard one interview you gave a few years ago where you likened Matilda from Roald Dahl to another X-Men, which I agree with. I'm fully signed up to that theory.
I think she easily could be. She has powers. She has telekinesis, right?
Completely. It's an unexpected spin-off, but I think it's absolutely canon. Growing up, similar to that, a show that you loved was Doctor Who. So, what was then the experience last year writing, not only writing, but being in an episode of that show?
The best way I can describe it, which I have described it, is with another word borrowed from religiosity, which is blasphemy. That's what it felt like to be given the keys to the Doctor Who universe and told to go forth and create. You know what I mean? It felt like peeking into God's workshop. And not only invited in, but said, "Here are the tools. What world can you make? Let's do this." You know, so it was utterly humbling and exciting, and the wildest dream come true. And they just allowed me to create a story that was completely seeped in my universe, in my proclivities as a writer, my concerns as an immigrant, as a black man, but also as a sci-fi nerd and a superhero fan. They just allowed me do everything that I wanted to do. You know, I've spoken about Spider-Man, and lo and behold, the sort of villain pulling this, the strings is Anansi, who is the first credited Spider-Man by Stan Lee, who created the Spider-Man thing. You know, so I really got to just to play. It was incredibly humbling.
Yeah, the keys to the TARDIS you were given there. How did it come about? Because I understand that Shooty was a fan of your work too, and was it did he originate it? Did you approach? How did the actual
It was a mixture of things. Because I'd been a fan of the show, they'd actually commissioned me before the pandemic, before 2020, to write an episode. One of the lead actors in Jodie Whittaker's run is a Nigerian actor called Tosin Cole, who I've known for years. I play basketball with him. And the whole time Tosin was in the show, I thought, bro, I'm gonna write an episode for you. Hang on, hang on. So I began to build a story about him, and a friend of mine worked on Doctor Who, knew I was a fan, so she got me into the room to pitch a story to the previous runner before Russell T. Davis took over. And I pitched this story, which he liked, but wanted me to do something different, which I pitched. But at which time Tosin had stepped away from the show. So I built this whole story around Jodie Whittaker's doctor. And I don't want to spoil it in case something else happened to that storyline, but it was brilliant. It was set in pre-colonial northern Nigeria. And just when we were close to, green lighting the episode, the pandemic struck. So suddenly we had to do everything and re reconstitute the stories here in the UK because we couldn't travel abroad. So I rewrote that episode. But then Chris Chibnall, who was the showrunner, then decided to write everything by himself, the final episode, sorry, the final series, which made sense because so much was in flux. It just made sense to just try and contain everything. So he did so. And at the end of that series, when it was broadcast, Jodie Whittaker has stepped away from playing the doctor. So suddenly my story made no sense and I just thought it was over. But soon after that, I heard that Russell T. Davies was coming back as a showrunner, and I'm a huge fan of his work. So the first thing I did was slide into his DMs and complimented him, saying how excited I was about what he's going to do next. And he responded very quickly, said, "Oh my God, I'm a fan of your work. Would you write for us?" And I said, "Absolutely." But unbeknownst to me, Chuti has also said he'd really like a story set somewhere in the African continent. Perhaps the doctor could meet the Orishas, which are the primordial beings I told stories about within the half cone of rainfall itself. So Chuti was interested, Russell was interested, and because I'd written already for the show, it just sort of made sense. And then we sat in a room and I pitched some stories to Russell and he liked what I had to say.
Yeah, and it's an incredible episode. It's such a and it's sort of it's standalone in the most sort of complimentary way possible. Is that it works as a sort of 40-minute play in a way as well as that. And it's so closely linked with Barbershop Chronicles. Was that sort of was that conscious? Was that just what came out?
The very first idea I had was much bigger and wilder, which would have been fantastically expensive, even given Disney's fat purse, which BBC was also spending from in order to create that previous series. And also, there was a lot I didn't yet understand about screenwriting. I know better now. Russell and I were discussing various things, and I said, "Okay, I like this, but would you suggest writing something set in a barbershop?" And I thought, "Ah, that I can do." So I sort of whittled the story down and decided to put it in one presence because both Chuti and Russell were fans of Barbershop Chronicles, which is this previous play I had done. But also, I liked the form because it put me under pressure as a storyteller, and I like pressure. It's one of the reasons why I'm drawn to poetry so much. Poets put themselves under an incredible amount of pressure to condense over and over again. We put language under pressure. We put meaning under pressure. We take a lump of coal and squeeze it until it's a diamond. That is why so many poets go crazy, or on some level, like anxious, depressed people, because you're constantly trying to do something you think you would fail at. Something more often than not, you do fail at, because the attempt to write a poem is often greater than the final results. You feel so much, and all you're trying to do is to say exactly how you feel, and the words get it all wrong. So anyway, going back to being stuck in a barbershop and thinking, okay, I can't go anywhere, right? We can't shoot on the streets of Lagos, on Africa, it'd be way too expensive. We're sort of doing this, within a very budget. We're shooting in Wales. What can I do here? And that forced me over and over again to think, what dynamics, what pressure can I add to this simple, specific space? And that forced the story to go in various directions, which I'm truly happy of being led to by those constraints.
Yeah, and as you say, so often the constraint leads to creativity, and it's through that compression that such great ideas come out. It was lovely seeing your cameo too. It was a sort of like
Yeah, there was this very cute thing where my partner, my family, and my five nephews and nieces all crammed into my flat and to watch the episode with me. But at no point did I tell them that I was in the episode.
Oh, that's lovely.
So there's this moment, that Spider-Man meme, where the three of them pointing at each other, where my nephews and nieces pointed at me sitting beside them and pointed me at the screen, whereas I was pointing to them because I got them, So it was just, I'll never forget it. Just a smile and shock and pride on their faces. That was beautiful.
That's so lovely. You're likely aware, if you're not, I found out you are only the fourth person in Doctor Who history to both write for and appear in the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's you are the fourth, and it's, I mean, near centenary by this point. It's kind of
That's amazing. I did not know that. Who were the others? Do you have their names there?
Glyn Jones, Toby Whithouse, and Mark
Okay.
Gatiss,
Okay,
and
cool.
well, yet more history being made.
Being made, yeah.
Talking of Barbershop Chronicles, you with the writing of that play, you successfully opened up a conversation about mental health, particularly within African men. And one of your recent exhibitions was on the Nigerian scams called Beware the. Is it the 419 or the 419?
419, yes, yeah.
Do you feel that you have a sort of responsibility to sort of rewrite Nigerian stereotypes and define what it is to be a Nigerian man?
I don't think I have a responsibility. I don't think I have it. I think sometimes I assume it because for the longest period of my life, I couldn't claim a British identity. It took 26 years or so to get a British passport, even though I was living in the UK in that time. So all I could do was claim the Nigerian identity whilst being here, which meant that I would wrap my arms around all aspects of it, the negative and the positive, the notorious and the haloed. And because I imbibed so much of it, especially when so much of it was based on the nostalgia, the memories, the rose-tinted lenses through which I saw and understood the Nigeria I had left when I was 12, I was constantly caught between the reality as I perceived it and the memory as it had been. And both, neither of them were safe spaces because they were constantly shifting. When we remember something, we remember the last time, remember it, not the thing itself. So this papering over, this reinvention. And then the present is constantly in flux. And Nigeria is so vast a country, 250 million people and 500 languages and, about 300 ethnic groups. So, we're just constantly churning out and agreeing and disagreeing with each other to try and understand that is also a Sisyphean task. It's pointless. So between all of these things, the attempt to understand Nigeria and redefine it was an attempt to claim, to hold on to something and pin it down, which means that ultimately I failed. But there's joy, there is exploration, there is invention in the attempt to do so. So I think it's constantly this need in me, especially because Britishness is also being redefined, and the space within it to redefine my Nigeria and my Nigerian identity in it. I say the space to do it here more than it is in Nigeria, because whenever I visit Nigeria, they call me Oyinbo boy, which means white boy, which means foreigner. So I can never be Nigerian enough for Nigerians. Here I'm distant enough where I can make up whatever I want, until of course Nigerian comes to the exhibition and tell me I'm wrong, which which is fine as well. We just agree with each other. But yeah, also as a worker of words, I understand some of the violence language, the English language specifically, has done to Nigerian identity, and what violence language can do when it's taken out of context to describe a people. So the attempts to redefine Nigerian identity with English is an attempt to dismantle the master's house with the master's tool, which means that I ultimately will fail because that is what happens. That is the end of that phrase. But again, there's joy in the attempts to failure because, like I said, trying to write a poem is to accept failure, and there's still joy in the attempt to do so.
That's beautiful. On that same sort of subject matter, your recent project, Stained Metal, I think is fascinating. It's your project of sending your 2023 MBE medal to the four corners of the British Empire, Kenya, India, Canada, and Jamaica, and commissioning artists from those regions to respond to a letter from you and presumably the medal itself. How did that idea originate, and how is it? Is it a completed project? Is it still ongoing? How is it going?
Firstly, it is still ongoing. It was supposed to be completed this year in May, but there have been new developments which can amplify the project exponentially. So we're waiting to see what that means and
Okay.
then figure out when next the project will happen. So it may happen later this year or even early next year, but it's still ongoing and I'm discovering and finding out new things. And the reason for the project is, triple fold. Actually, it's more than triple fold. There are many, many reasons why, but primarily, I am used to sitting in limbo. As I've described, 26 years, neither belonging to here or there, and finding the gumption to create art out of that neverwhere, meant that when I was stuck between a British identity and a Nigerian identity, an MBE just seemed to be the cherry on that non-existent cake, if you know what I mean. So, and there were lots of debates about people of color, specifically people of color from Commonwealth countries who then come from places that suffered under imperialism and colonization, what it means to accept a garnish for being part of this sort of poisoned pie. And lots of people stepped away and thought, no, it is disgusting to do so. You're spitting on on the graves of your ancestors to accept it. Whereas for me, I thought I can lean into that complexity by turning it into an art project. So, and like I did with Barbershop Chronicles, where I traveled to all of those six countries from which I found information to write the play, I wanted to do the same thing with the MBE, send it out, see what comes back to you, and figure out what you could turn that into. A sense of community is foundational to my practice. as an artist, which is why my favorite plays are about a community as opposed to an individual. There's the socialist streak which underpins all the things that I create. So therefore, rather than keeping the medal here in the UK and questioning each other or staying in this sort of intellectual bubble, I decided to just democratize as much as possible and send it out to the world and see what happens, so that when those conversations come around, which they always do, they can be informed by those who are most affected by the legacy of empire, which isn't us here, it is them. So that's what I was trying to do, just to broaden all our collective horizons and enrich the conversations, but also engage with some really cool art, which I can't wait to show all of you guys.
Yeah, I'm incredibly excited about it, and I'm glad that it seems like there's something to sort of turbocharge it or something like that that's upcoming. You mentioned there about traveling to the various countries for in research for Barbershop Chronicles, and you've spoken before about how you feel there's too much emphasis placed on invention in Western writing. It's been overpraised versus just copying basically verbatim life that's sort of being begging to be written down. And you spoke about how you went to barbershops in various countries and would ask permission to record conversations going on. And the biggest pushback you got from the conversationalists were, "You've interrupted our flow. You should have just recorded anyway. How dare you? You've spoiled my joke now. I need to go back to what I was saying." Why do you think there is such a sort of as you say, sort of overpraising a higher emphasis based on invention as opposed to verbatim, sort of copying.
I think capitalism. I
Okay.
think predominantly, I think that's it. I think if one person claims to have created something, then they can own it. Therefore, they can sell it, you know. Whereas if a community owns something, then it becomes like communism, which for some reason in the West we think it's the antithesis of life and beauty and inspiration and self-respect, which is, you know, rubbish. But I think predominantly capitalism, ownership, law, it's built around the individual. It's capitalism is underpinned with a hierarchical structure where there's an individual at the top, right? Who claims and pulls, and it's this, you know, it's this all powerful, all wise, all knowing sort of artist who sits in the dark and mines, you know, the human void or consciousness for truths that they then disperse. And there's something so untrue about it, which has always irked me. It's my biggest ick in life, you know. So going out and just listening to people is a truer representation of what it is to make art, because no man is an island, no artist sits on an island. They're constantly regurgitating and, you know, recreating what it is they have taken. You know, they slap it onto canvas and cite your name on and pretend to be have the instigators of it, but it's simply not true. But also, you know, just borrowing from hip hop culture, for instance, this was the entire music created out of poverty, where the DJs would take records of other artists and strip it down and put it up, and the MC was just the person with the microphone telling an audience about themselves in rhyme. Right. So the experience was communal itself. And what he did was put pressure on language to turn it into art, right? Which is exactly how I wrote Barbershop Chronicles. But also, I think it's what poetry truly, truly does. No poet worth their salts invents new words. What they do is find juxtapositions of other words which force new meanings, right? And also, words change their meaning, right? Which means that the poem is gonna fall apart at some point, but the context is what holds the meaning of a poem, and the context is defined by the community. So constantly, it's a communal attempt to understand, to create meaning. The poet is just the person holding the pen, whatever it is they tell you, whatever it is, however genius they are the mouth pieces of what it means to be alive right now. They are just witnesses. They can, dance around that or present whatever it is. They can win great awards, be heralded as geniuses, but they are ultimately writing about other things and other people because the poet sits at a desk. They are not living. If they are living their life as, at breakneck speed, sorry, then they are not writing poetry. Someone that requires you just to sit in a room with a pen and see the world around you to figure out how to narrativize the complexities of that world. So it's all communal. I just declare that it's communal and write places and write plays and poems that center on the community rather than center on myself.
Yeah, then that's fascinating. When I was considering what you could mean by the overpraising of sort of invention, I never considered effectively intellectual property law to be the defining You've spoken a lot about poetry in that answer there, and poetry, it seems for you, is inextricably linked with an incredible gentleman by the name of Stephen Devine. And I was hoping we could talk about him now. If you wouldn't mind talking about your friendship with Stephen and
I've written about Stephen a lot, and I've spoken about him in many interviews because, in the nicest possible way, that little numbskull haunts me. He was the person I discovered literature with when I lived in Ireland. He was instinctively verbose and artistic in his sentence construction and in his wit. Our attempts to entertain each other was purely to do with language and argument and trying to out bamboozle each other with language and out talk each other. The point wasn't to win, the point was the communion of words. And Stephen was depressed and failed to articulate his depression or find the language to explain what underpinned it for various reasons, which I'm hidden from because he's no longer here. In my penultimate year, Stephen took his life. And the first poem I wrote was an attempt to memorialize one of our stupid arguments. So I started writing to be a witness to a memory of a boy I'd loved and lost. And it underpins my poetry. I'm always haunted with what the world could be. What it means to be here, and what it means to lose a key member of a community, and then try to write of that community at large, whether it's masculinity, whether it's an immigration community, is a communal experience of migration, whether it's blackness, whether it's religiosity, so yeah, that experience of sitting beside him in almost all my classes for 2 years and suddenly losing him, and understanding the ripple effects of my community really underpins again how I try to create art, how I try to be welcoming and open and create soft spaces for hard topics.
Thank you for talking about him. He sounds like a really beautiful human being.
Oh, he was a knucklehead, he was an idiot, but he also was a beautiful human being, but it was a pubescent, horny
Sure.
Irish boy who drank too much, cussed too much, and loved to argue. But yeah, there was a lot of beauty in all of that, a diamond in the mine.
Yeah, the two of you had sort of particularly close connection when it came to Shakespeare too, which was really lovely.
Because of his intellect and his wit and his verbosity, we didn't need our English teacher to translate Shakespeare for us. I grew up reading, Dickens when I was 9 years old in Nigeria, so I had a huge vocabulary anyway. And Stephen loved that he'd found someone else who could geek out, who also understood Shakespeare without translation. And our English teacher liked that us nerds could do this. So a few times in the class, he just asked us to translate Shakespeare to the rest of the class. And at the time, I was the only black boy in my school in Ireland. And my teacher, who was the poetry teacher and the basketball coach, I think he knew what it meant to ask the African kid to translate Shakespeare to the rest of this, all whites class, understand the power dynamics, inherent in that. And later on, I went to design and run the first arts festival in the school, become the vice president of the student council. And a lot of those things I did with Stephen, beside me. So my knowledge and understanding of Ireland and my constant love for it is deeply tied to him, and the experiences and understandings that came with this safe space beside me, who was talking about Shakespeare and talking about the characters trying to shag each other and pulling out the bawdy meanings behind illustrious Shakespeare's language.
Incredible. And just finally, before we move on, I believe he had an affectionate nickname for you. That's to do with it.
He called me Sheikh Al Spear. Sheikh because of my Muslim heritage, El, the first syllable of my name, and Spear because of my African identity and the weapons we used to resist, at least attempt to resist British imperialism and the aesthetics of that, which pops up across African visual art. So, he just called me that, which was an interesting and fun, but also inciting nickname because it shows his understanding and his ability to weld cultures. He called me a poet before I ever took it seriously, but clearly he was riffing on that same on those batteries as well.
Completely. You mentioned a little while back about in regards to receiving the MBE that a lot said no, but you said yes, and it reminded me of another story of how the year after Gaddafi died, the British Council was wanting some artists to go to Libya and run some workshops, and potentially understandably, a lot said no, thank you. You said yes, and you said yes within 10 minutes of receiving the email. Why?
I don't know, a little bit of good old-fashioned Nigerian braggadocio, a blind faith in humanity and the power of art. Wanderlust, as a migrant. I think I wanted to be back on the African continent or in the Middle East in that part. It was a number of all of these things. It's just a lust for adventure, And I've always never believed what I read or what I see on Western news. And I think more and more we're understanding now that it's a program, which means the editors have an agenda, And knowing how Africans have been described in Western entertainment for generations, for centuries, I was always skeptical of what I was hearing about Libya and what I'd heard since the fall of Gaddafi. So I just wanted to go and experience it. Because I'm a workaholic, the idea of just going to someone's country to chill, on holiday is just never quite strikes me as a valid cultural interaction because of how sanitized it is as a tourist. But going with the British Council meant I was going to work. I was going to sit down in a room full of literary people who are considering ways to articulate their current complexities. And so I just left at the opportunity. It was just it ticked several boxes for me. And it was utterly fascinating. I'll never forget it.
What's the standout memory from your time there?
Meeting the national with the director of the National Theatre of Libya and him describing me as a Gaddafi supporter and meaning that as an insult. I think that was fascinating, but also understanding what it meant to be a nation grappling with itself, trying to forge a new identity, and honestly trying to do so, with young people struggling to resist that. It felt really exciting. There was so much hope in the air, and unfortunately, Libya's, devolved into a sort of lawless land, and now we understand more and more the evils Gaddafi was holding at bay. He tried to explain it to us then. The West didn't agree. We created a monster, then punished him for being the monster, then killed him at the end, not understanding that there were bigger monsters in the dark that he was keeping. We understand that now. So I just really wanted to see that, and I'm grateful that I was able to see that and witness that and speak to Libyans who warned me then about everything that we're seeing now.
Sure. Yeah. You mentioned a moment ago about not liking to basically just go on holiday, just to go to another country and chill. What media do you consume to switch off? What do you do at, 9 p.m. after this? What are you gonna? Do you?
No, I do. I go the into I feel like I go into seasons. There are times when I'm really obsessed with podcasts and I listen to them around the clock nonstop. And sometimes I listen to podcasts and they are points of research for things I'm working on. So I do that as well. But when I'm not listening to podcasts, I'm constantly watching television series, as opposed to films, actually, more series. I like to understand the visual storytelling form more and more, and also character development and how to build and unite and deconstruct and surprise over and over. I work in screen, so I'm trying to understand that more. I don't watch as many movies as I should, and I don't listen to as much music as I should. So I think podcasts and TV series are my go-tos, but I'm also a fan of animated storytelling. So I'm trying, because often the budgets are vast compared to shooting, but also they can be more imaginative and more daring because you're not risking anyone's body. It's just a stroke of a pencil on a piece of paper, and then the animated world after that. And also the space to create really interesting aesthetics within the visual language. And you can see so much of the culture at play. Some of that is in the animated sequences in my Doctor Who episode, where we found an artist who was of Nigerian heritage, therefore could create imagery to tell a West African folk tale in a very culturally specific way. Sometimes that is a layer above the understanding of the character, the risk and jeopardy, etc. So I'm beginning to watch more and more animated stuff just to understand that.
Yeah, that's really interesting that sourcing a Nigerian artist for those, because it did have that visual authenticity when watching that. It really sort of stood out. This 26-year saga of obtaining British citizenship, that to describe it as Kafkaesque would be putting it mildly. And during that time, of course, your work was being staged at the National Theatre and on that sort of ticker tape across the South Bank. What was the emotional resonance then of your work being chosen to be on the A-level syllabus for the nation?
That, I mean, that was crazy, really, and humbling and fantastic for all of those reasons. I feel as if I'm giving back to the English teachers who invested in me when I was a kid. I'm able to say all those kind words you'd said powered this thing, and you can now share and teach with it as you shared and taught with me. I'm a lot of those plays have little seeds that were sowed by my family, my sisters, my nephews and nieces. In fact, the main characters in Barbershop Chronicles, Ethan, Malachi, and Emmanuel, Those names are from two of my nieces and so sorry, two of my nephews and their father. And
Oh,
I'm
that's cool.
really looking forward to them studying that school, that play in school, and to say, not only is this about my country, that character is named after me. You know, I'm the expert here. That sense of power dynamics that I experienced when my teacher put me as the expert, you know, I'm trying to lay the seeds for them to do so when they're in their school. So it's sort of cyclical, it's deep, it's hopeful, it's giving back to the community that, you know, served me when I was a kid.
Yeah, that's going to be such a beautiful moment for them, and that sense of sort of that power dynamism, and also just a sense of, it's hard to describe what level of pride they would feel, I think. Are they close to that age? How long ago?
My eldest nephew is 13, so yeah, he's close to it. In the next couple of years, he'll be studying that.
Well, speaking of that, what plays and poems by black writers in particular, do you feel will become essential reading in the near future?
Ooh, that's a good question. What plays in the near future? There's a play I'm looking forward to called The Afronauts,
Okay.
written by I think it's Caribbean, British Caribbean playwrights. His first name is Ryan. I've forgotten his full name, but I think it's something like Ryan Calais Cameron or something like that. It's going to be on at the Royal Court, and it blends, you know, African stories with the science fictional world, and sort of outer space up the narrative, things like that. So I'm looking forward to that, and I'm hoping it becomes a sort of modern day classic. You know what I'm saying? So that I think will. So besides the Afronauts by Ryan, I think Eclipse by Danai Gurira will become one of the epics. It tells this incredible story about women who are married to the same warlord, and just the nature of survival, feminine strength, feminist relationship, feminism as a whole in an African context is incredible. The characters are so rich, the stakes are so raised. I think there are five or six women in this underground bunker. Display the spectrum of femininity, and it's just this fantastic play. I saw it and I was sweating watching that play. This incredible Irish director directed the production. I saw at the Gate Theatre here in London, and it was phenomenal. I think that play is already a classic and just deserves to be done over and over again. But you know, there's so many plays incoming by writers of African descent that I can't even. There was a point where there weren't enough, and therefore one would be a big deal, and now there's just so many. So I'm pleased that I can't give you a straight answer.
There's a great response to it. How involved are you in the production of your work after it's been written? Do you hand it off and you're done with it, or what's your process there?
If it's the first production of a play, I'm very invested and very involved. I sit through as many rehearsals as I can. I feed back to the directors and to the actors and all members of the creative team. And often I rewrite the play through the rehearsal period for various reasons. Sometimes I find an actor's strengths and weakness, and I write the play to avoid their weakness and make them stronger. Sometimes they expose my strengths or weakness and a writer, and they can help me cover up, you know, my fault as a, you know, putting on the play is an intensely communal experience, and the story is what you're all serving, not myself. I'm not serving them. I'm not serving the set designer or wardrobe. We're all working together to tell a story as clearly, as succinctly, and as sensorially as possible, you know. So, yeah, I'm involved in the entire process. And once the play is up, the first production, I sort of sit back after that. And if people want to do another production, I just let them do what they want. And usually, if they want to change anything for any reason, they ask me for permission and I say yay or nay. But for the very first production, I'm as involved as possible.
That's fantastic. And it's lovely how you write for the people in the room. And it goes back to what you're saying about sort of it being a communal art form. And clearly your love for and consideration of fellow artists in pursuit of creating art is incredibly vivid. And that's lovely that you write to their strengths, and it's not, oh, you're failing my text, you need to work better. It's how can I support you to excel? And then like the rising tide floats all boats, presumably.
Exactly. It's often what I think about poetry, actually. If I write a poem that isn't understood by the reader or the listener, I blame myself. I created the work, right? I didn't write wisely enough or inclusively enough to understand, to hold their potential interpretations. And again, trying to do so for the whole world that way lies madness. It's impossible. So I do the best as I can, but it's ultimately my failing if someone misunderstands me. It isn't, I don't think of it as theirs. So I try to be as inclusive and communal as possible, which means my relationship with language changes, but also because of the power dynamics involved in my life as a British subject, or rather descendant of British subjects, formerly colonized people, I understand what it means to read a text that tells me that I'm stupid, and also understand that the text doesn't allow for my own intellect because it was conceived outside of me and I was written out of it, or it was conceived of in far distant lands. So when I write poetry, I'm also aware of that the person reading this, English might be their second, third, or fourth language. And if they don't understand it, I can't say they're stupid because they're incredibly verbose in their own languages, which I don't understand, And if they were to write poems for me and I don't understand it, I wouldn't say they're stupid. I think, oh my God, I don't understand the language. I'm the one failing. So between all of that, I try to write texts that are as inclusive as possible.
And seemingly more than achieve that. Hearing you talk about art is incredibly exciting and incredibly encouraging. You've very kindly agreed in a moment to end the show with the recitation of the poem we talked about before, one of my favorites. But before we get to that, one question that I ask everyone who comes on the show is, why do we need stories?
Why do we need stories? I think it's primarily for comfort, or for the illusion of comfort. The world is chaos. The universe is monstrously indifferent to the presence of man. It's a line in one of my poems, which I think I riffed off another poet somewhere, but because the world is chaos, what the human mind attempts to do is impose order. And when we impose order, we are able to project meaning or sieve the order for meaning. And with that, we're able to live and create patterns and predict what we're going to do 2 weeks from now, 2 years from now, 2 decades from now. This is what story does. It helps us find patterns and then find meanings. That's why we need stories. It underpins our humanity. And we all want stories. I think it's very possible to live without stories. Many animals do, many breathing things on Earth do, but specifically humanity need it in order to be human.
That's beautiful, and I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for talking to me today. If you wouldn't mind, it would be lovely to hear this incredible
Yeah.
work.
Thank you so much for bringing this to my attention. I forgot this poem exists, so I might try and do something with it now, actually, and bring it back again. But this is the poem, The Child God of Chaos, commissioned by Jigsaw, the clothing label. Her first scream split the midwife's ring and caught the defibrillator's wires to confetti. Her giggling drove nursery schools to hysterics, and her breaststroke rose tidal waves each lap. Her bacon pillowed the whole house in clouds, and dancing threatened its concrete foundations. Her singing caused the male choir's discord and stuttered the organist's fingers to a stop. Her driving lessons gave highways nightmares, and her brake lights discoed traffic lights dead. Her kisses caused murmurs in her lover's heart, and her lovemaking crushed hip bones to flower. Her runaway from home sparked a black hole, and it grew to completely consume her friends. Her mood swings ruptured weather patterns, and her merest indifference iced over lakes. She heard of a hurricane making for the city, and entering quietly, she welcomed the storm and found her life's calling and saved us all.
Inwa, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dom. Thank you.